Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I told you it was going to be a good show today. What a fine hour talking about John the Baptist with Steve Ray. And you feel like you could do 10 more hours on John the Baptist. And thank you very much to everybody who called. This hour, as promised, Father Tad Poholchik from the National Catholic Bioethics Center here. And it's a bioethics open forum. You can call and ask whatever you like about bioethics. You want to talk about life, the treatment of life in any of its stages, all the modern technologies and the things that go on in hospitals, maybe a particular concern that you have in the family. It's all welcome. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. You don't have to be Catholic. You don't have to even be Christian or a believer to call. Thinking through bioethics is an act of reason. Certainly the light of revelation assists that reason, but we'd love to have a reasonable conversation with you about any issue on the table with bioethics. 888-318-7884. Father Tad Poholchik, thank you very much for being here.
Well, great to be able to join you again, Cy. Always enjoy doing the show with you.
Well, thank you. I think I feel like the reason that you enjoy it is I think I'm the only one who says Poholchik, right? I think all the other radio hosts say Father Tad because they're cowards, frankly.
You know, I think you're right. I think you must have really done a lot of practice. Because
I did. I practiced in front of the mirror for a long time to get that right. The National Catholic Bioethics Center in Philadelphia, you can go there when you have questions, or you can just call Father right here, 888-318-7884. Father, you might have thought that we were past slavery here in the United States. But an AP article from just last week, Associated Press article from just last week, says a judge, and this was a South Carolina judge, uses a slavery law to rule that frozen embryos are property. I would have thought that the 13th Amendment vitiated the slavery laws, that you couldn't use them. But one is just aghast reading a headline like that.
Definitely. I think the notion of embryos as property is something that has been kind of being bandied about quite a bit. It's mm-hmm. something that has been in the court system on and off, and it comes up a lot of times, as you might imagine, when you have divorce proceedings and there are frozen embryos in the deep freeze, and one of the members of the couple says, you know, the wife says, I want to get pregnant. And the husband says, I don't want you to get pregnant with those embryos. And there's a battle. And then who gets the embryos kind of thing, you know, along with the cars and the dog. And it becomes very, very unfortunate when judges use this kind of language, I think. Although there is an element in which I think this shows us where we are today in some of the thinking around human embryos. We've managed to do a lot of, to use the fancy word, depersonalizing of embryos.
Right.
You know, we don't really see them. I mean, they're so unfamiliar to us. And we say, gee, that doesn't look like a human being at all. It doesn't look like you and me. It doesn't have hands, doesn't have feet, doesn't have eyes for me to look into. you know, how can you expect anybody to treat that the same way that you treat an adult who's walking down the street? And so it is understandable, because of course the wisdom of the church here would say to us that we're not supposed to have access to embryos directly. We're not supposed to have them stored by the millions in the deep freeze. None of that is supposed to have happened. You know, the proper place for an embryo is in your wife's womb, and shouldn't be in the laboratory, shouldn't be, you know, under the bright lights, manhandled, manipulated, and so on. So we've sort of stepped so far away from the natural order of things, from the proper order, that we now have this, what appears to us to be a kind of object that's in front of us, a thing, rather than, you know, you and me as we once were, because that's the truth of the matter. That's the cold, hard fact. All of us were embryos at one point, and it actually wasn't that long ago for most of us. I mean, life goes very quickly.
Right, right. And there was a kind of desensitizing and depersonalizing that was required for American chattel slavery, certainly. And I do think part of the reaction to this, what this judge says, is that's about the most horrible thing that can happen to an American, is to be equated with a slaveholder, or to be slaveholding, that kind of thing. But these children are, these tiny little human beings are in a similar situation, not perfectly analogous, but similar situation, in that their fate is entirely in someone else's hands now.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Their fate is entirely in someone else's hands. You know, I remember years ago, I was talking with a woman who had done in vitro fertilization, she and her husband, and then she came to regret it deeply. She had a conversion, and it was a beautiful, beautiful thing. But you know, one of the things she said to me, she said, every single year, on the date that I did IVF, I pick up the phone, I call the IVF clinic, I make sure my embryos are still there, still safe, because I'm worried, you know, that they may have been thrown away, they may have been given to another couple, something may have happened. And, you know, you could just hear the sadness and the emotion as she shared this story with me every year, repetitively. And she understood exactly what you're saying, which was that her children, the fate of her children, were completely in the hands of these brokers, these individuals, you know, who are running these clinics for large profit margins. And there's a real vulnerability that her children were being exposed to. So it's a very sad tale of woe. And as you can imagine, at the Bioethics Center, we get a lot of questions about, well, what do we do? You know, we have these frozen embryos. We've got six or seven of them, six or seven of our kids. And now we realize we shouldn't have done this. Where do we go? How do we proceed? We're too old at this stage to get pregnant as a couple. So how do we go? And it is. It's just excruciating sometimes to hear and to see what people have sort of backed themselves into a corner with.
The number here is 888-318-7884. We're talking bioethics with Father Tad Poholchik of the National Catholic Bioethics Center. 888-318-7884. So I do think that just like any kind of dehumanizing, this is not natural. However, I think sometimes we act like it's just natural to not be able to, you know, identify with an embryonic human being. But if I remember being a child in the science class and they had the little chart of this is what the baby looks like at this age, and it goes back to a smaller and smaller circle. And I think as, you know, 7-year-olds, if you had said, well, how should you treat that little baby? Because no one would use those words now because we don't want to admit this. Then as 7-year-olds, we would have known you shouldn't hurt that child. So it's not natural to just be so callous. I think that's a learned thing.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I sometimes tell the story. This was something from the New York Times a number of years ago. You have all these people who are working in these fertility clinics making these embryos. And in certain places, like in Great Britain, they have a law that has a time limit. In other words, you can only keep the embryos frozen for so long, and then they must be discarded or destroyed. And so when that date finally comes around and the couple has not done anything with their children, then the clinic workers are like, oh, gee, you throw them away. No, I don't want to do that. Oh, you throw it away.
Yeah.
And, you know, finally, it often ends up that none of the clinic operators will do it, and only the guy who owns the clinic, he's got to step in and be the one who, you know, in effect is becoming the executioner of these little embryos by throwing them down the sink and destroying them. So, you know, that's just, again, as you're saying, a reminder. You saw it in seventh grade. You could tune into it. The workers in the clinic know that if they take those same little embryos and implant them, somebody is going to have a beautiful baby that they hope to take home. So it's very clear what these embryos actually are. And when we sort of shift into the euphemistic language where we sort of beat around the bush. We're just playing games with ourselves. We're not fooling anyone.
888-318-7884 is the number. Got some folks on the line, but there are two lines open if you have a question about life in any of its stages, the proper treatment of human life, the proper use of the new biotechnologies that are springing up every day. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
If it's central to the faith, you can find it on EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of EWTN radio, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free. The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central. It's like podcast heaven. Visit EWTN.com/radio/podcasts today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking bioethics this hour. One thing I have learned doing these shows over the years with Father Tad Poholchik is there's always some new thing that I have never heard about, but Father has heard of it. And if you have a question about it, well, maybe you work in one of the technology fields and you want to ask a question about what is ethical to do and what you should avoid doing. Maybe this is something that's in the family or just something that you're curious about as far as the ethical treatment of life. Give us a call, 888-318-7884. As I said, most of the line's full now. So Father, if it's all right with you, we'll just head to the phones.
Absolutely. Sounds great.
All right, let's go to Linda in Brooklyn, New York, listening on the Google device. Linda, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Father.
Oh, hi.
Hi, Linda.
I'm thinking about the vegans and how they eat and how they cannot eat meat, fish, dairy, anything. They cannot eat anything but vegetables, so to speak. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Hold on.
We were about to get another TV show.
I'm talking to you on my house phone. Is this vegan diet, is not killing animals, is this something that Catholics should be aware of and not to follow? Jesus did eat fish. He did not just go eat vegetables. Is this a political thing? Is this something that people do? I don't want to go against the faith.
Okay.
I don't understand it.
All right.
I would like to understand the Catholic view.
Okay, Father?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of levels here. First of all, animals, like plants, are part of creation that God has provided to man to be used in reasonable ways. And I think the question becomes, what is reasonable use of an animal? And certainly eating it for one's own survival or eating it for nutrition doesn't raise any kind of moral or ethical problem. There are situations, though, where I think, for example, in the production of something called foie gras, where you take a goose and you put a tube down its throat and you force feed this goose for a number of weeks so that the goose becomes extremely obese and then its liver becomes pathological, it becomes highly enlarged, and then you slaughter this animal, that you've more or less been, you know, mistreating, really, outright mistreating, if not torturing, in order to get a kind of creamy pate. So I would say, you know, that represents a situation where we are not respecting the rest of creation. We're abusing it and kind of misusing it in a fundamental manner. But simply, you know, eating an animal for direct consumption, one maybe that you've hunted, or even one that has been, you know, properly raised and taken care of, doesn't raise any problems from that point of view of using creation in the way that the Lord has opened it up to us to be used. So, you know, there are lines here that are maybe at times a little challenging to distinguish. I think some people would say, well, what about laboratory research where you're using animals or animal products? Aren't there situations there where animals, again, might be misused? And I think that's why you do have these ethics review boards at universities that will review grant proposals to check into that. Because, again, there's a sense that there are lines here and we need to make sure we have a sufficiently serious reason for doing experiments on animals. And, you know, certainly finding cures for diseases constitutes a very important reason for doing animal research. And there will be many other legitimate reasons as well. But it's always good that we be reviewing this and looking closely at what it is that is being proposed as a research direction. So, Linda, I hope that helps clarify a little bit the parameters here.
Somewhat. I'm not sure about if this is a political thing, not eating animal products. I don't understand that part.
Linda, yeah. Would you like to know if it's wrong to be a vegan? Are those people doing something wrong?
That too, yeah.
Yeah.
Is it wrong because they don't eat what everything that God created?
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's another good question. The question of whether being a vegan is wrong, I think there are certainly indications that not including meat in your diet may not be good for your health. So there may be a sense in which, despite your good intentions, you are harming yourself by going down the path of veganism, by depriving yourself of certain needed types of nutrients. So in that sense, one could make an argument that exercise proper stewardship over the gift of your own body by, you know, not eating properly. And now this same type of an argument could clearly extend in many other directions. I think a lot of times the question of whether our diets are what they should be in terms of the way God would have us protect our bodies and take care of them, treat them as temples of the Holy Spirit, I'm sure, you know, there are shortcomings there on the part of many, many of us, especially when we have so many different types of food, some of which are extremely highly processed and may not be, you know, very nutritive in their own way. So I think veganism raises those types of concerns about one's health. And, you know, veganism goes further. I mean, I think it becomes a kind of ideology where one is, in a sense, elevating animal life to a plane that isn't appropriate. And that can be a mistake as well, that you treat animals as if they're on the same plane as humans, which they certainly are not. They are very different. We, it's true, are animals, but we are animals with a difference, a big difference, a fundamental difference.
Linda, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that call. I'm going to head all the way up to Nova Scotia, Canada now. Rob in Nova Scotia, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Rob, go ahead with your question for Father.
Thank you, Father. A purely factual question. Is it true that a frozen embryo has only a hate to say it, shelf life of about 5 years?
Interesting question, Rob. No, that actually is not true. And the reason I can say that with a high degree of certainty is because there are embryos that have been frozen 17 years. And I believe there was one recently that was 19 years that was thawed and then implanted into a woman and grew into a baby without any difficulties. So the shelf life, as you call it, is not that short. It's not 5 years. We actually don't know what the shelf life of a frozen embryo would be. When you freeze these embryos, you're putting them into liquid nitrogen, which is extremely cold, and basically it sort of halts all the molecular movements, or almost all the molecular movements inside that embryo. It kind of becomes locked up in itself. But it's not a complete and perfect stoppage of everything. So there's some slight movements that may occur of molecules. And with time, there may be, in fact, some degrading. But I suspect that this is going to be more on the order of, you know, tens of years or maybe even hundreds of years that it will be possible to still retrieve a and successfully implant and gestate it. So the five-year figure is not accurate.
Rob, thank you very, very much. The number here, 888-318-7884. We're talking bioethics. Of course, we started the program talking about frozen embryos and their status as persons or their alleged status as property, according to some federal courts here in the United States. But you can call about any aspect of bioethics. You want to call about what happens late in life, what happens in the midst of life, anything about the new technologies. All of them are welcome. 888-318-7884. Go to Dallas, Texas now. Christina in Dallas, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Christina, go ahead with your question for Father Tad Boholczyk.
Yes, Father, my daughter and her husband have been open to life and fully following the Catholic teaching for the 11 years of their marriage, but yet I have been able to conceive. I have read some program about adopting embryos. Is that something they would be ethically allowed to do, to adopt, quote, an embryo and have it implanted?
Okay, Christina, this is a nuanced question. It's a question that has not been definitively settled by the Church. But the most recent document out of the Vatican, which is called Dignitas Personae, on the dignity of the human person, there are a couple of sections in there where they deal with this. And if you read the document closely, my read of it is that the Church is basically getting to the point of saying, no, you cannot adopt somebody else's embryos in this way. You know, we all feel kind of terrible about the fact that we have so many of these embryos trapped. And every day in every major city, we have more and more of them being produced in assembly line fashion. So when we see that, there's a natural kind of reaction of compassion that we all have. We say, we want to save these embryos. We want to help these young humans who, through no fault of their own, ended up on ICE. But there are concerns here, and I've done a couple of debates on this. I did one recently at the Catholic Medical Association in Denver at their national meeting. And I'm convinced that embryo adoption of this type, where a husband and a wife or the woman would be implanted with somebody else's embryo, involves a violation of marriage, that there's a sense in which a woman's power to gestate is connected to the reality of her marital relationship with her husband, that power of gestation is not something to be pirated, even for good ends like rescuing embryos. It is only to be drawn into reality through acts of self-giving between a husband and a wife. That's how a woman is meant to become pregnant, not through a kind of, you know, uterine intromission, if you will, to use a fancy term, by a clinic operator that makes her pregnant. That there's something there that is opposed to the designs of marriage. That's my opinion. So the church, you know, officially has not settled this 100%, but that most recent document is pretty strongly leaning in the direction of saying that this is something that should not be done and that it raises a number of concerns. And it does say in that document specifically, I believe it's paragraph 19, although you'd have to double check me on that, that in cases of infertility, it is specifically not allowed, disallowed. So I hope that's helpful, Christina.
Christina, thank you very much. We are right up against the break, so we'll take the break. We'll be right back with more Bioethics with Father Tad Boholczyk on Catholic Answers Live.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Anna Mitchell here. Tomorrow morning on the Sunrise Morning Show, Liz Lev takes us to the Church of St. Pudenziana and the Church of Cosmas and Damian, two of the Lenten Station churches of Rome this week. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Father Tad Boholczyk is a priest of the Diocese of Fall River in Massachusetts, but he's in Philadelphia at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. If you don't know about the National Catholic Bioethics Center, please familiarize yourself with it, because all kinds of wonderful help, you know, even on issues that most of us will have, you know, not obscure issues, but most of us will have to deal with, like the living wills and the end of life decisions and the medical decisions. They have wonderful helps there, applying reason and applying the light of revelation to problems that they didn't have in the Bible. They didn't have CRISPR technology or whatnot. And so we have to use our minds, and they got some great minds over at their National Catholic Bioethics Center. If you have a question, you're welcome to call Father while he's here, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Let's go to David in Cleveland, Ohio, listening on 1260 AM to start this segment. David, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Father Tad.
Yes, good evening, Father. Quick question on, I hear a lot about gain-of-function research, you know, in politics, especially after the COVID. And I was wondering, what exactly is that? and is it moral to do gain-of-function research?
All right. Gain-of-function research really did shoot into prime time, if you will, because of COVID, as you pointed out, and because of what may have been going on in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. We're not sure because a lot of the records there ended up, the hard drives ended up being wiped clean. But what this involves is taking the genetic sequence for a virus and making very small changes to see whether the virus becomes, for example, more virulent, more capable of being transmitted, whether it binds more avidly to a particular receptor, that kind of thing. So, you know, you might say to yourself, well, gee, that seems like a really bad idea to be doing any research like that. And certainly in the sense, if you're dealing with something that is a threat to humans, I think that's a good first instinct for us to have. But if you were to ask scientists, you know, why would you do gain of function research? The answer would be, well, if we can understand better how these viruses work, how they attach themselves to particular binding sites, we will be able to potentially design better drugs, better therapeutics, and, you know, come up with better treatments so that fewer people will end up dying. But on the other hand, if you do modify one of these viruses and you make it more dangerous, and then you have a leak out of a lab or something, then you may be indeed in a situation that is potentially disastrous. And, you know, we're not 100% sure what happened in China. The evidence seems to be growing that there may have been some kind of lab leak here, but the jury still seems to be out on the matter. But if that's the case, we all see what happened. We had basically the whole world shut down as a consequence for close to 2 years. And so there are dangers here. So your question is it ethical? Well, if it's being done in animal viruses that don't pose any threat to humans, and it's being done to elucidate fundamental mechanisms by which these pathogens work, then there's probably not an issue. But I think as soon as you step into the domain of anything that could involve humans, then this becomes much more tricky. And you have to have laboratories that have extreme containment built into them. They're very, very tricky to maintain all of the controls that are required so that the gain of function research can be done safely with a human pathogen. And the other angle is that if you have people doing this who are intentionally looking to weaponize a particular pathogen or virus, then of course this would be unethical at the outset. It would be immoral and should not be pursued if that was at all in their perspective or viewpoint for motivating them.
David, does that all make sense to you?
Yes. That's a lot more clear. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. You say that with such clarity, Father, about the weapon, but people are making weapons out of viruses and bacteria.
Yes. I mean, they certainly are, and they have in the past. And there has been a recognition, too, that this is the kind of thing that we need to have international conventions.
Yeah.
Because these things can be disastrous. It's like chemical weapons. You know, at a certain point, you can just say to yourself, well, this type of fighting of a war would be so disastrous that we all have to agree that we just can't go there at all.
Yeah, because you can think of a virus, a weaponized virus, in many ways, seems even more grave than a chemical weapon in that it could just be more or less eternal. Like it could just be there forever, never go away.
That's right, and be self-propagating. In other words, just keeps going from one person to the next. The chemical weapons, you know, they have a range. When you disperse them over a certain area, then they settle into the ground or dissipate into water or whatever, and then they're less of a threat. But with the virus, this could just keep being transmitted from one person to the next. Although, you know, often it is the case that immune systems will kind of come up with a counterattack. I mean, the bubonic plague that was in Europe for that, you know, long period of time, humans did adapt, and eventually there were, you know, small numbers of survivors, but then their immune systems were passed on to their children, and there was a greater ability to fend this off, as it were.
You know, the question that David had was about gain of function research, and there's also the possibility this is just a naturally occurring something that somebody ate an animal or interacted otherwise with an animal and got it. And I assume there's also the possibility that it's a naturally occurring virus that maybe occurred in a bat or you know, some other animal, but someone collected it, brought it to the lab, cultured it, and that's how it got out. That's also a possibility?
That's correct. In other words, without any gain of function research, simply that they procured it out of a cave somewhere, you know, deep in China, and this just increased the likelihood of human exposure to something that otherwise humans really would not have encountered. And that is a working theory as well. And there may have been an intermediate animal. There's an animal called a pangolin, which some people have speculated may have gotten infected from a bat. And then in the meat markets in China, the pangolin, which is a kind of delicacy and it's used for certain medicinal purposes, that may have been a vehicle for transmitting the virus to humans. Yeah. But, you know, it's hard to sort of post haste go back and trace exactly how this happened.
Yep, yep. David, thank you very, very much for the question. It's amazing to think of the world shutting down for years and still we're, I don't know. We just don't know why we did it, why it had to happen, what brought it on.
I agree. And I think this is, you know, a moment in which we really should be clamoring for answers and insisting that, you know, all the data around this be made public. Including, you know, research that may have been sponsored through United States entities, because we had some connections from our labs over to those ones in China. All of that, you know, we can't have anything here. This was such a phenomenon, such a terrible thing, that we really do need to have this out in the light, in my opinion.
888-318-7884 is the number. We're talking bioethics with Father Tad Poholchik. We have several folks online. We'll get to them when we come back, but there are lines open if you have questions in the area of bioethics, whether you work in the area or you have some other reason for the question. You are welcome to call 888-318-7884.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
This is Dr. Ray Guarini from The Doctor Is In. You call in, and we will talk about what matters to you in your life. We can put our heads together to help you solve the problems of life and to use your faith to get even smarter.
The Doctor Is In with Dr. Ray Guarini. Tomorrow afternoon, 1 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. We're talking bioethics with Father Tad Poholchik of the National Catholic Bioethics Center. We'll go to William in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on the Quest app. That's Quest Radio there in Atlanta, Georgia. William, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Father.
Thank you. So I do a lot of listening to science and futurism, and one of the things they talk about a lot is coding out animals' DNA, and then when you get to another planet, you just print out the DNA in some format to hopefully make an animal. Would that be, if we could even do it, would that be ethical?
So it sounds like you're referring to turning it into information. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. First of all, I think in the current state of the technology, we're not able to do that with any kind of reliability, partly because the entire genome of a typical animal is very, very large. We're talking multi-million base pairs. So you would need a massive machine, let's say you're on Mars, to, you know, string together and produce a de novo genome from a particular animal if you just had the information. What I think is more likely to be of use in terms of this interplanetary travel would be to actually bring some cells of an animal that have been frozen, and then to do something like cloning later with those cells, taking the complete genetic material itself as your starting point. But even to do that, you still do need some method to gestate. So in other words, if you think you can only bring the DNA or a single cell and then recreate an entire animal, that's not possible at this stage of the game. You need to have a recipient animal that you could make pregnant. And so, for example, the woolly mammoth, which has gone extinct, they have been trying to get a cell out of some of these frozen samples that they've come across. But then the question becomes, you know, which animal would you impregnate as you do a kind of cloning step there? Would it be an elephant? What would it be that would work? And that's a tricky question. So at this point, for the interplanetary travel, I think at some point you're going to have a little bit of a Noah's Ark thing where you do get some real animals there first before you then, you know, bring in some other technologies like you're describing using DNA.
But it would be ethical, right?
Would it be ethical?
Yeah,
the issue there would be, is animal cloning, for example, ethical? And animal cloning doesn't raise fundamental problems. For example, racehorses are being cloned routinely. The ones that are, you know, most successful, most muscular, people are trying to clone them to get successfully, you know, copies of winning racehorses. Some people have chosen to clone their dogs and their cats. And it does cost a lot of money, and I think the question of, you know, what's the motivation here should be addressed, but it's not immoral to do cloning of animals. Cloning of humans, on the other hand, raises very, very grave concerns that we are, in effect, producing human beings outside of the marital embrace, and we are instrumentalizing really their production into a kind of manufacture protocol. And that's something that we should never be doing. All of us are entitled to be loved into being in the marital embrace. So that's, you know, one of the problems with human cloning. But animals, there may be circumstances when it will be indicated and not unreasonable to do it. So it's not unethical per se. And, you know, if there were some technique like you're describing where you were printing animal DNA and carrying it to another planet and you could reconstitute an animal, I don't think there would be a fundamental problem with that. Again, as long as you were doing it, say, to produce animals that you could then eat and have meat and be healthy, et cetera, it shouldn't raise fundamental ethical problems.
William, thanks very much for the question. Lots of folks on the line, so on we go. Anne in Illinois, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Anne, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Father Tad Poholchik.
Sure, thank you. I was wondering if you have stored embryos. I know there's no proper way to dispose of them, but would it be appropriate to have them buried with you? Because there's really no good way to dispose of them that's proper.
That's correct. And I mean, I think the problem with your proposal that you have a mother who maybe she dies and then could her frozen embryos be buried with her, the problem here is that would be sort of like saying, well, you've got a mother who is 45 years old and she gets cancer and she dies and she has an 8-year-old daughter. Should we bury her 8-year-old daughter with her? Well, of course not. You know, we all recognize, no, I mean, that's not something you would do. Her daughter is living. These embryos are living. They are human beings. They are, you know, the children of that mother. So it wouldn't be appropriate to bury them because they're not deceased. Now, if you knew that they had already died, then, of course, it would be fine to bury those embryos. You know, this is similar to a case then, well, I mean, it would be have some parallels to a case of a miscarriage where a mother loses her child early and she asks, you know, can we bury the miscarried child in the family plot? And the answer is definitely yes. And it's a wonderful thing to do that. And, you know, sometimes you can ask the parish priest and he'll say some prayers there at the committal service, etc. So, you know, we have to just make that distinction, of course, between the living human beings and those who have died.
Okay, Anne?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. It's bioethics this hour with Father Tad Poholchik. If you have a bioethics question, well, I guess it's getting to be the end of the day. If you have a bioethics question, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Cynthia in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. You are up next, Cynthia. Go ahead with your question for Father.
Wonderful. Thank you. So my question, Father Tad, is with regards to GIFT, which is gamete intrafallopian transfer. For couples that struggle with infertility, is this licit according to Catholic teaching?
All right, Cynthia, good question. This is another one of those questions that has a bit of nuance to it. GIFT, gamete intrafallopian transfer, maybe just for the benefit of the listeners, let me just summarize what it is. It's a process where a woman's egg is taken, it's put into a tube, and next to it, but separated by an air bubble, her husband's sperm is introduced into this tube. So the sperm and the egg remain separate from each other in the tube. Then the tube is introduced into the woman's fallopian tube and pushed into her tube so that if there is a conception that happens, it happens inside her body. It does not happen in the laboratory or in glassware. The question of whether it is allowable really hinges on the matter of whether one is assisting the marital act by doing this process or whether one is actually replacing it altogether. And I'm convinced that this is an example of replacing the marital act. Part of the issue is that one needs to obtain sperm, and the only way this could be done licitly or in an allowable manner would be to use a perforated condom which had no spermicide, so that during normal marital relations, some of the sample would pass through, but a little bit would be retained and could be collected and then used for the gift procedure. But I think it's pretty clear when you look at the gift procedure and that inserting of the tube into the woman, it's not really her husband here who is making her pregnant. Her husband is becoming a gamete donor, a sperm donor, and then somebody else is stepping in and, you know, going through some different steps and procedures in order to make his wife pregnant. So I'm convinced here that this does not fulfill what the church teaches is required, namely that we are assisting the marital act. Instead, it appears that we are replacing it. However, as I mentioned, there's not a church document anywhere that will say outright that gamete intrafallopian transfer is always wrong. What the church does instead is just provide those principles that, you know, we've just looked at about replacing versus assisting the marital act. So I don't know, does that clarify it, Cynthia?
It does. It does. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia. Excellent. Thank you very much for the call. I imagine that among the issues you deal with all kinds of issues. Infertility is a particularly painful, and I imagine that there must be a very strong temptation to just move forward, even when things are unethical, because of the overwhelming good of desiring of the child. The child itself is such an overwhelming good.
That's so true. And I would say, honestly, Cy, in my experience in dealing with couples, a lot of times the impetus or the driving force here does tend to come more from the wife's side. The husband will often say, well, you know, I want my wife to be happy, whatever she wants to do, you know, I'm not going to get in the way. And the woman often is very, very committed to having a child of their own flesh and blood. So, it ends up being, of course, it's a good desire to have a child of your own flesh and blood. But the problem here is that one is stepping into means that are disordered and disruptive, really, to what a marriage is about. And I think it's an area that we in the church have not done a very good job, really, of explaining or teaching around. And it's interesting that you mention it, because I'm setting up at the moment to give two big lectures on in vitro fertilization and infertility at Ave Maria University in Naples, Florida.
Yeah.
And that's going to be in October. So I just mentioned that, you know, as a kind of heads up, especially for any people who are in that area of the country, it may be an opportunity for them to attend. We're going to have basically the better part of an afternoon where we discuss the ethics around this.
We don't have time to take another call, so I won't give out the phone number again. But Darren, there's a group that we're going to do an interview with that helps parents deal with the fact of infertility when it has become clear that there are not ethical means that are efficacious right away for that couple, although they always stress God can do miraculous things and they have seen that. Do you remember the name of the group, Darren? Springs in the Desert. Are you familiar with Springs in the Desert?
I have to say I have not heard of Springs in the Desert.
They're not doing anything medical. It's entirely a kind of support for Catholic husbands and wives who face infertility. And it's a kind of, I suppose, very, very Christian in the sense of bringing a life out of this experience of grief and the death of a hope that the couple shared.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think that kind of accompaniment and support for couples is so important. And I think it's an area that larger parishes will sometimes set up special ministries for infertile couples to provide mutual support in navigating those difficult waters.
Yeah, because we're in a certain sense, you're asking, I mean, I suppose it can't, heroism might not be, but you're asking for a hard sacrifice on the part of an emotional sacrifice in any case, because as I said, the temptations are everywhere. You're saying don't give in to those, but then on the other hand, where's the support for the person who says, all right, I'll do what the church says?
Yeah, and I mean, it is a real sacrifice. It's also, though, I'm convinced, another moment of invitation from God.
Sure. Yeah.
Because what he'll say is, you know, how am I leading you to discover real fruitfulness of another type in your marriage? And he always has another plan.
He does indeed. Father Tad Poholchik's our guest. Check out the National Catholic Bioethics Center online. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.